You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Through his books, The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto, Michael Pollan redefined the way many of us think about healthy eating. He's done a great deal of research and come up with an often quoted simple and effective summary of his findings. Eat food, mostly plants, not too much. He visited us last year to discuss his latest book, Food Rules and Eater's Manual, in which he outlines 64 rules that lead to a healthy relationship with food. And it's just been released in a new edition that features an updated introduction, 19 added rules, and illustrations by Myra Kallman. It's published by Penguin, and I'm very pleased it has brought Michael Pollan back to our show. Hi.
Hi. Good to be back.
In the updated introduction, you begin by saying that you thought the book was done back in 2008 when you handed it in to the publisher, but you were wrong. What was missing?
Well, what was missing was, the book is really about the conversation of culture. It's about curating the wisdom of our culture about food, and there still is some wisdom out there. And I found that people were sending me new rules. I was getting this, people wanted to continue the conversation. And they said, you know, my grandmother used to always say, put a bouquet of flowers on the table and everything will taste twice as good. So I had these extra rules that I really wanted to include in a subsequent edition. And then my wife came up with the idea of inviting Myra Kallman to collaborate. And because she's, not only is she a great artist, but she clearly has a thing about food. I mean, if you saw her show at the Jewish Museum, you know, she had real live onion rings framed on a wall and beautiful paintings of Snickers bars. And so I thought that she really captures the spirit of pleasure in food and community in food. So it would be great to do it again in a very different, more beautiful edition.
Did you have any input into what she would illustrate and what she would put in the book?
Yes and no. We went back and forth, and I was collecting new rules, and in fact, I did a solicitation to the membership of Slow Food, and they put out 100.
And you only came back with 19?
Yeah, well, some of them were really not very good. I'm trying to keep the quality up, Lenny. People came back with rules like, French fries you eat off someone else's plate carry no calories. I vet the rules, and I couldn't vet all of them. And one of the things that was actually striking—
That goes in Tony Bourdain's book.
Yes, exactly. He can have that one. And one of the things that was very striking is that a lot of the rules that came back were rules that were already in the first edition that people just think now are pieces of culture, like don't eat anything your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. So I would send candidate rules to Myra for her opinion and was she interested in illustrating it. And then she would also come to me and said, we need a rule about coffee. There's nothing about coffee in the book. And I hadn't given much thought to coffee, so I went out and researched a rule about coffee, and which, by the way, it's fine.
But aren't the rules about what we should eat always changing?
No. The nutritional wisdom about food is always changing, and that's because the nutritionists don't always know what they're doing.
Keep on getting new ways of – the government keeps on issuing new guidelines.
Exactly. And new nutrients to obsess about. And the knowledge of food hasn't changed very much. The knowledge of nutrition has. So for most of our lives, we were told to worry about fat in the diet. We've had this low-fat and no-fat campaign since basically 1977. It turned out to be really misguided. We got very fat on a low-fat diet. The nutritionists were wrong. And we were wrong, too, because we use that as an excuse to eat carbohydrates.
But there's also, right now, there's a tyranny of low-fat. If you want to have whole milk yogurt, for example.
You can't find it.
Yeah. You may find one hidden away in the back.
Yeah.
But it's past the date you're supposed to buy it.
And you know what's really weird about that? You will see if you can find that full-fat yogurt, it probably has less calories than the low-fat yogurt because they amp up the sugar in the low-fat product.
And then there's buttermilk. It seemed to me the whole idea of buttermilk is for it to be buttery, and then you have low-fat buttermilk,
yeah, or no-fat cream cheese. It's supposed to be creamy and cheesy. And what's going on here?
So are those things just as good for you in the whole version? For me, it's a matter of taste.
Yeah, I would say in some cases they're better because they're simpler, more wholesome products made without lots of additives.
And that's what your grandmother would have eaten.
Yeah, and there's not, you know, I tend to think, I've got a rule about avoid foods with the word light, L-I-T-E in them, or no fat, because they tend to have just as much or more calories. Calories are really the issue, not fat. There's nothing wrong with fat in the diet, and that was just a big mistake. And in fact, there's very little science correlating fat in the diet to heart disease. So I basically say eat a little bit less of a full-fat product. Absolutely.
Julia Child used to say the same thing. Don't put a lot of butter in it every day, but to make this dish correctly, you got to use
that
much butter. On the other hand, Paula Deen says you got to use a lot of butter no matter what you're cooking.
Yeah, well, and there we do get a lot of butter in restaurant food, but I cook with butter. And, you know, that's a great example. I mean, the wisdom of the grandmothers was butter is good, wholesome food. And then the industry and the government came along and said, no, margarine. Polyunsaturated fats are better for you. And they stabilized these fats with hydrogen and gave us trans fats, which we know are lethal. It's one of the few things we know in nutrition science. Trans fats give you heart disease. And so we replaced a real food and with something that it was really bad for us. So another rule is, you know, avoid foods that lie to your body and are imitating other foods.
Now, your first rule is to eat food. That seems obvious, but don't we just do that?
No. I think the supermarket today is full of products that we shouldn't dignify with that beautiful word. And I call them edible food-like substances. And a lot of the book is giving people screens or algorithms to help them distinguish the real foods from the edible food-like substances. And I think we should really treat these things different in terms of taxation policy, in terms of how we sort them in the supermarket. And so that's why I say, you know, one of the rules you've heard from many people is shop the periphery of the supermarket, where the real food lies.
Because that's where milk and
produce
and vegetables
and meat and fish. And now there is something going on here, though. There was an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal the other day that the packaged food makers want to move into the produce aisle and capture that halo of health and wholesomeness. So you've got they kind of started with the croutons and the ranch dressing, but they've got bigger plans, and now the pum juice is in there. And so they're kind of trying to muddy the waters, as they always will, between real food and edible food-like substances.
Now, your second rule says something that you mentioned earlier, that we shouldn't eat anything that our great-grandmothers wouldn't recognize as food. Isn't that the same as what you just said? We have to eat food because our great-grandmothers would not have recognized all of these processed foods.
No, because they wouldn't. And that's
although it started in the 19th century, didn't it?
Well, processing
margarine was invented in the 19th century.
End of the 19th century. And by the way, when it was first introduced, it was called imitation butter. And in 13 states, you were required to dye it pink so nobody would mix it up.
And
which
in
is
New
a
York,
very good idea. I think we should go back to that.
And in New York, actually, until the law was changed, I don't know if this was a national thing, you bought it in some kind of a plastic thing with a yellow dye, and you could break the yellow dye and then squeeze it into it to make it look like butter, but it had to be sold looking
and
white.
Looking white. That's great. That's a great story. That's before my time. But I think that, a lot of the rules, especially in the first section, which is the eat food section, take you to the same place. They're just different mnemonic devices. And if the grandma rule helps you, great. Some people say, my grandmother is a terrible eater and a terrible cook. I don't want to go with that. Although I say you can pretend you have a Sicilian grandmother if that would help. But this rule, don't eat anything with more than 5 ingredients, or don't eat anything with ingredients your third grader can't pronounce. All these take you to the same place.
Although chefs practically always make things with more than 5 ingredients. You're
and recipes are different. I'm talking about processed foods. I'm talking about foods that have, 20 ingredients. I mean, there's a new kind of whole wheat bread that Hostess has introduced, and it's whole grain white bread, which is kind of a miracle of food science. And you look at it, and it's got 33 ingredients. Now, bread is a simple food. It's really flour, water, and yeast and salt. That's all you need. So what's all that other stuff?
And I was wondering about peanut butter that was more than peanuts and maybe salt.
Yeah, that's right. And now it's got sugar or high fructose corn syrup and hydrogenated oils. And so there's an enormous desire on the part of industry to complicate foods, and they do it mostly for their interest to stabilize it, get a longer shelf life. But they're also doing it to press your buttons. So they're taking things that were never sweetened before and putting high fructose corn syrup in it. And peanut butter is a great example.
And we're seeing that all over the world. People in Mexico complain that now that when you get packaged moles, for example, a lot of the old ingredients, because they included 20, 30 ingredients many cases, have been replaced by sugar and a couple of other things that mask
cheaper.
The taste.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, a lot of work goes into making mole, right? You're you know, cooking all these different peppers and drying them and grinding them and then all these nuts. And if you can simulate that with a couple artificial ingredients, the temptation to industry is fierce, and they will do it.
Well, in the past, we would have said if we just ate the kinds of diets people eat in other parts of the world, everything would be okay. But aren't people in other parts of the world now imitating the Western diet?
Yeah, they are. The Western diet is taking over the world very quickly. It's very glamorous. Fast food is prestigious food in many developing world countries. There's also this sense that the food is sweeter, it's more accessible, it's convenient, and people like convenience in their food. It offers a lot, but the main thing is it's been engineered to push your evolutionary buttons with salt, fat, and sugar in combination.
And meat. You get a lot more meat in the Western diet.
That's right.
There will be meat in a dish, a Chinese dish, but it will be a flavoring element.
And that's a really key principle, is putting meat back in its place, get it off the center of the plate. This is for health reasons and environmental reasons. I mean, we simply can't afford to have a world where everybody's eating 9 ounces of meat per person per day, which is what Americans now eat. So I have rules about, you know, instead of 8 ounces of meat and 4 ounces of vegetables, why don't you reverse it? 8 ounces of vegetables, 4 ounces of meat. Meat is wonderful. I love to eat meat. I love the flavor of it. But all these, as you mentioned, these traditional cuisines used it as a flavoring, not as the center of the plate.
Are we bringing our kids up wrong? Because the conventional wisdom is that kids don't like vegetables. But they eat vegetables in other parts of the world and don't think twice about it.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we're always that good at the way we cook them. And we haven't had really fresh, wonderful vegetables. If you take kids to the farmer's market or to a garden, they will eat vegetables with great pleasure. Things that have been on a truck for 5 days, they're less enthusiastic about, and with good reason. They have good taste. I think we're making mistakes with our kids in lots of ways. Another way is the way we socialize them about how much to eat. You know, we ask our kids, are you full? That question is teaching them to eat until you're stuffed. You know, in France, they have a very different language around hunger. You know, when you're hungry, you say, j'ai faim, I have hunger. And when you're done eating, you don't say, I'm full. You say, je n'ai plus faim, I no longer have hunger. And that moment is many bites short of feeling full. And so we need to ask our kids a different question, which is, are you satisfied? Are you still hungry? Not, are you full?
Did you grow up in a household that sent out all the wrong messages?
No, I mean, I was very lucky. I had a mother who loved to cook and was a wonderful cook, is a wonderful cook. And we didn't get that message, you know, you have to finish what's on your plate. I don't remember that, you know, people are starving in North Korea. I heard that from my grandparents, but I didn't hear it from my parents.
Oh, we only heard India. I guess it was before
North Korea. Yeah.
Rachel in Connecticut writes, I have high cholesterol and I've become mildly obsessed with Smart Balance products. What are your guests' thoughts on Smart Balance? Are they any good?
I think that's a pretty ultra-processed product. I think people have specific dietary problems sometimes. There is a small subset. Cholesterol is one of the great misunderstandings of the last 30 or so years. For most people, and this may not apply to the questioner, for most people, dietary cholesterol in the food, as in eggs and things like that, or butter, does not translate into elevated cholesterol in the blood. There is a small subset of people, though, for whom this is true. And if your doctor has confirmed that that is a problem you struggle with, then you should follow the advice and avoid animal fats. For the rest of us, you know, eggs have been completely rehabilitated.
It's the same thing with eliminating gluten from the diet. There's a small group of people who have a problem with gluten, and yet we're seeing this explosion of people.
Everybody's flocking to gluten-free products.
Do you have any idea of why?
Well, we do have a higher incidence of food intolerance and allergy, which is unexplained. It may have to do with the hygiene hypothesis, the fact that we're not exposed to as many microbes as children, so our body's a little confused about a friendly molecule and an unfriendly molecule. And then we have fads. People, you know, who get gluten out of their diet are convinced they feel better. And they probably do feel better, but it may be psychological. So I don't want to suggest that gluten intolerance is mass delusion. It's not. But the incidence of gluten intolerance is rising a lot faster in the marketplace. In the marketplace, there's more of these products growing much faster than the actual cases of gluten intolerance. There's also a new test, so you get more diagnosis.
Well, if I were filming The Graduate today, I would, instead of saying classics, I'd say gluten. Michael Pollan is the author of 6 books, including In Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, all New York Times bestsellers. He's also the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley. His latest book, actually, this is an updated version of his latest book. It's called Food Rules and Eater's Manual, now with illustrations by Myra Kalman and added rules. It's published by Penguin Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Michael Pollan. We're talking about food. His latest book is Food Rules and Eater's Manual, updated with illustrations by Myra Kalman, published by the Penguin Press. Foodborne illnesses have been prevalent in the news recently. There was a listeria outbreak linked to cantaloupe, which really struck me as odd. I understand spinach, yeah. But cantaloupe is a melon, and it has a covering, and yet we had that problem in September. Recently, the Osamu Corporation recalled 1,800 cases of tuna because the FDA found elevated levels of histamine and decontamination. And I wondered how something can go through that in a can. I thought that cans preserve things.
Well, they do normally. They sterilize things, but not, you know, you can get botulism in a can that can survive in the anaerobic conditions. I'm not familiar with the tuna outbreak. The listeria in cantaloupe is kind of a mystery. You can convey a contaminant on the surface of a melon into the center with a knife. So there's no guarantee that, you know, you really do have to wash the outsides of produce. There are a lot of reasons for this. Each of these outbreaks has a very specific source that hasn't been identified. In this case, just filthy conditions in the packing plant, it appears, that's what the FDA thinks was responsible. It points up to the fact, though, that we don't have adequate inspection by the FDA, and that our food safety, they don't have the budget. You know, they passed a new bill last year, the Food Safety Modernization Act, but the Republicans have refused to fund it. So the FDA does not have the firepower it needs. That said, the FDA is also using its limited resources in really weird ways that I don't understand. For example, sending SWAT teams to go after tiny raw milk producers rather than Jack DeCoster, the guy who's sickened 1,400 people with his eggs in Iowa. I don't understand what that's about.
In fact, none of these outbreaks have been tied to small farms, local farms. They've all been big agribusinesses. So why do you think that is? Is it just simply agribusiness has more lobbying power?
Well, I think that that's part of it. I think that there's some political theater going on. I think when the Food Safety and Modernization Act was passed, there was an exemption carved out for the first time for very small farms. If you had less than $500,000 in sales or sold locally, you were exempt from certain provisions. That probably really irked the people at the FDA. They don't like the idea of making distinctions based on scale. So I think that they're trying to demonstrate that small farmers can have problems too. And they can. There's no immunity of small farms to microbes. The key difference is that an outbreak on a small farm is going to sicken fewer people. And if you have limited resources, you should focus where you're going to get the biggest bang for the buck, and that's on the largest producers.
Earlier this year, Walmart announced a plan to lower the prices on fruits and vegetables, and they are backing Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. Do you think this will make a difference when it comes to delivering better food?
I think we have to wait and see. I think that Michelle Obama struck a deal with them and that they've committed to making produce less expensive, also to buying it more locally. Walmart's way to make prices, everyday low prices, has often involved really squeezing their suppliers. And they promise in this case that they will drive these efficiencies out of their own supply chain. I think, you know, you wait and see. They make these promises, and as journalists, we need to monitor them and see if they actually stick to them.
They've also talked about going, selling more organic produce.
And they have. I think they're the biggest seller of organic produce in the country right now.
Is organic something that really is something that should be the key factor in buying something? Because organic can mean it came from China or Chile or
organic,
any part of the world, doesn't it?
You're absolutely right. Organic, I mean, organic's a very important category. It's carefully audited. If you're really worried about pesticides or the way the land is treated or the way farm workers are exposed to pesticides, it's a very good choice. Is it always a healthier choice? You know, I think for me, the first step, a lot of people can't afford organic. The first step is to eat real food. Eat fresh produce. Even frozen produce is a very healthy option for people. Whether it's organic or not, the more important thing is to eat those fruits and vegetables. Then if you can afford it, organic is a great thing to add on. But you can eat very well without eating organic. And so I don't think that should stand in the way of people changing their diet.
Well, but people do argue that you should eat in season and you should try to eat locally grown produce as much as possible.
As much as possible.
You can't eat locally grown oranges, for example.
No, you can't. And, you know, I'm not a kind of a zealot of a locavore. I eat bananas, and I live in California where we can eat local oranges. So I'm very lucky that way. But I think that there are a lot of virtues to buying locally. And, you know, the food is just better when it's fresh. And I'm really surprised. I've been in New York for a couple of days. How many restaurants have asparagus on the menu right now that are otherwise very sustainable? I don't get it.
Why has the Obama administration been so hesitant to implement and suggest changes in food policy?
Well, they have suggested some changes. I think that there's a real split between the East Wing and the West Wing. And in this case, the East Wing gets it, and the West Wing doesn't quite as well. Michelle Obama's done very, very important work raising the profile of this issue. And also democratizing it as an issue and showing people that it isn't about just buying organic. But it's been controversial. You know, when she called her garden an organic garden, the pesticide industry came after her and came after the president in a big way. The Crop Life Association said she should be using pesticides whether she needs them or not. Now, she laughed that off, but then her husband actually hired the head of the Crop Life Association and gave him a very big job in the Department of Agriculture. So I think that, you know...
Sounds like mixed messages to
me. It's very mixed messages. But I think that one of the things that's going on is hopefully, and I don't know if they're thinking this way, that Michelle Obama is building a larger constituency for reform of the food system. And if that's their strategy, I think it's brilliant.
Well, the president definitely talked about health care as one of the major issues of his presidency, and a law was passed, although we don't know if it'll ever go into – it'll actually be implemented. But as you frequently point out, Western diet and illnesses like cancer and diabetes are linked. So isn't it in our best interest just in terms of our health policy?
Without question. I mean, the easiest way to save money on – healthcare costs, and you know we're spending over $2 trillion a year on healthcare costs, three-quarters of which are going to treat chronic diseases, most of which are linked to our diet. Changing the American diet is really the only solution to the crisis of healthcare costs. And do I think the president understands that? Yes, I think, but it takes a lot to go up against the food industry, and he doesn't yet have the political winds at his back.
My guest is Michael Pollan, whose latest book is an update of Food Rules, an Eater's Manual with illustrations by Myra Kalman and 19 added rules. It is published by the Penguin Press. We have a listener who suggests a rule. He says,
please,
take all you want, finish all you take.
Take all you want, finish all you take. I don't think so. I don't know if I'm on board with that. If you're full, don't finish all you've taken. One of the odder rules I added that people don't really see as a food rule is compost. And if you compost, you will be more comfortable throwing out food and buying fresh food. A lot of people are intimidated about buying fresh produce because they're afraid they won't get to use it and it'll go bad in their fridge and they feel there's a rebuke from that wilting head of broccoli in the fridge. If you have a compost pile, you know you can use that food to feed yourself down the road in your garden.
You can also feed your worms.
Exactly.
In a post in the New York Times website last month, you said that a properly rewritten farm bill would score every provision. What did you mean by that?
Well, in the same way, when we're debating other pieces of legislation, we have the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, score it for how much money it will save. I think we need to score all our agricultural policies for their impact on public health. And if we looked at subsidies, say, corn subsidies, and said, is this going to have a positive or negative effect on public health in America? We need to align our health goals with our farm policies. And that's where we're really getting into trouble. Right now, the government is supporting both sides in the war on type 2 diabetes. They're subsidizing the high fructose corn syrup, and they're paying to treat all the type 2 diabetes. That's crazy.
Some of the other rules that you have are that you shouldn't eat in front of the TV.
Yeah. I think in general,
eating alone. Why is that bad?
Well, have you seen how you eat in front of the TV? You kind of mindlessly, like, you know, reach into the bowl and eat, and it has nothing to do with hunger. It's just an absolutely when people eat alone, when they eat in the car too, they eat too much. They eat mindlessly. And conscious eating is really the key to healthy eating.
Well, we often eat our lunches at our desks because we don't have the time to go out. Is that bad too? Do I have to find some table and
I think your employer should give you enough time. I mean, part of the idea of the slow food movement, which I subscribe to in many ways, is it was not just about putting better food in front of people, but creating a society where we could slow down and have an adequate. You know, in Italy and France, the kids have an hour for lunch. They sit at tables. They're served. These ideas seem crazy to us, but they make good sense. We eat way too fast, and we eat on the run. And by the way, this is not new. Americans were famous for their careless approach to eating all through the 1800s.
And it's the reason that we eat sandwiches with our hands, and until recently, Europeans ate them cutting them with a knife and fork.
Well, that's crazy. There's nothing wrong with picking up a sandwich.
In a new book called Fed Up with Lunch, a Chicago public school teacher writes about her experiences eating the cafeteria lunch every day, and the meals are less than appealing, to say the least. What do you think about school lunches? Why are they so bad?
School lunch is a disaster. You know, our kids get 40% of their calories at lunch, and those calories tend to consist of French fries. And we need to change that. And we're trying to change it right now. And Michelle Obama proposed or worked on a school lunch reauthorization that would have eliminated all that starchy vegetable matter. And in fact, it's being attacked by Democrats and Republicans from potato-growing states. And they have succeeded in beating back a limitation on French fries.
Now, potatoes are perfectly wonderful. But French fries are not necessarily the best way to prepare them.
Or potato chips. And, you know, usually they put in potatoes just to get up the calorie counts in these lunches. And, look, I love potatoes. But French fries, I have a rule about French fries. You know, eat all the French fries you want as long as you cook them yourself. And then you'll eat the proper amount of French fries because they're a pain to cook.
The Chicago public school teacher, points out that a slice of pizza meets the USDA's requirements for two servings of grain, but rice only counts as one. So we also have these weird loopholes in our food
policy. Well, the rules are really obscure. They're written at a time when we simply needed to get more calories into our kids. Remember, the school lunch program began because the armed forces were complaining that Americans were too scrawny during World War II. So there was a moment where we had to simply get more calories into the bellies of Americans. Now our problem is not inadequate calories. It's too many calories. Yet our school lunch program still has calorie minimums and no maximums. So we need to rethink it from the bottom up to serve healthier food and not focus on jamming calories down their throats.
Is this the responsibility of our schools? I just was handed a media advisory from Food Bank. Food Bank's cookshop program is enlisting nearly 450 New York City public school teachers to participate in their nutrition ed training, and they hope to reach 35,000 children and families in public schools and after school programs.
Look, I think that change in the American food system and culture will begin in the schools. And we need to teach kids not just what real food is, but we need to teach them how to grow it and how to cook it. Because if you teach kids how to cook, they will know, for example, that French fries come from potatoes, which most of them don't know right now, and will learn what they need to know. Because knowing how to eat well, how to feed yourself well, is one of the most important life skills you can teach a kid.
Well, some of the schools, including one around the corner from me, have now put in programs where the kids grow things, and then they cook them. So they develop a whole new relationship with food.
But and vegetables in particular. And they start coming home and say, I want kale.
An article in Crain's New York uncovered that schools in New York City were importing their applesauce from China, despite the fact that New York is the second biggest apple producer in the United States.
Well, this is our globalized food system. Sometimes it's cheaper to bring your apples in from China. It's cheaper right now. You know, people are out there buying sustainable wild salmon from Alaska that's been shipped to China to be filleted and then shipped to New York. We have some, you know, basically insane from an ecological standpoint supply chains, and New York schools should be serving apples from New York State.
I'm going to read some of the things that our listeners have written in. A listener asked about your thoughts on Gary Taub's research into why we get fat. His new book says that certain carbohydrates have led to our current obesity epidemic.
The evidence that carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates in particular, are more at fault for obesity looks pretty strong. And I think that Taubes is basically on the right track. I think he is in danger of obsessing about a single nutrient. And in general, I think we should be talking about foods and not nutrients. I think as soon as you demonize a nutrient, any nutrient, you give a free pass to another nutrient. So his focus on carbohydrate could lead people to binge on fat. And that's not a good idea either. We really have to move the conversation back to foods. The nutritionists need to look at nutrients because they're reductive scientists and there's great power in that. But as eaters, we can tune all that out and just eat real food.
Wendy in Paramus says, steamable rice and potatoes in plastic pouches are so convenient. Are these microwavable pouches safe?
I don't know. I can't tell you with any certainty. I mean, there's an effort, you know, to change the kind of plastics that are used and that they're using really inert plastics and not dangerous ones. I think frozen vegetables are a great alternative, as I mentioned earlier. But, you know, watch out for the fake herb butter sauce.
Mark Bittman has advocated flipping portions around so that a vegetable frittata might become vegetables with a little bit of egg. Do you think that's a good way for people to measurably change the way they eat?
Well, I don't have an issue with the eggs. I would add a little bit more egg probably than he would. But I think putting vegetables at the center of our meals is just a good thing. I mean, people in countries where they eat a pound or more of fruits and vegetables every day have half the rates of cancer we have.
You say that we should avoid products that contain high fructose corn syrup, but not for the reasons that we usually hear. Why do you think we should avoid them?
High fructose corn syrup may well be no worse for us than sugar. And it's wrong to think, based on current science, that there's something specifically, you know, evil or toxic about it. My problem with high fructose corn syrup is that it is a marker of a highly processed food. I mean, who cooks with high fructose corn syrup at home? Do you have any in your pantry? No. This is just an industry tool.
Isn't Cairo syrup?
I have corn syrup, but it's not high fructose corn syrup. It's basically gluten syrup, and which is used for cooking various things and is a legitimate ingredient. The other problem with high fructose corn syrup, though, is it shows up in products that were never sweetened before. Things like ketchup, condiments of all kinds, breads. You know, you never put sugar in breads, but now they put high fructose corn syrup in bread because it browns nicely and we will eat more of it.
And now the Corn Refiners Association has changed the name to simply corn sugar.
Well, they've tried. They've got to get the government on their side, and the government hasn't yet been willing to move. You know, is that a terrible thing? I think a more accurate name, if they're interested in being more accurate, would be enzymatically altered corn glucose. And if they'll get behind that, I'm with them.
Just one more thing. When you were here a couple of years ago, you said that the food movement was at the same place as the environmental market pre-Earth Day. Do you still feel that way? Have we progressed?
I think we're making progress. I think it's important to understand what a young movement it is. It's still pretty inchoate and not that well organized. It has many different factions. But there is a groundswell, and you see it. What is really heartening is that young people have seized on this issue, college students in particular, as their issue. So I think you're going to be hearing a lot more from it. I think the Farm Bill will become a national debate and not a parochial piece of legislation. although this particular year it's being written in secret in a very undemocratic way. But that may break down. And so I think we will see a lot more politics around food, yes.
Well, there is the other side of it. Almost every candidate running for president has said they want to get rid of the FDA.
The FDA? On the Republican side?
Yes.
Yeah, well, if they think that the government doesn't have a legitimate interest in preserving the safety of our food, defending the safety of their food, I think that's the kind of government regulation most Americans are happy to stand behind.
Michael Pollan's latest book is Food Rules, an Eater's Manual, updated with illustrations by Myra Coleman. It is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you for being with us again.
Thank you. Always great to be here, Leonard.